restraint, and we think of powerful people as generally having the freedom to behave as they wish. Indeed, as you may have noticed in your own professional and personal life, people in powerful positions and those who feel powerful often act without fear of negative consequences. In one study, people who felt powerful were more likely than those who felt less powerful to switch off an annoying fan while working on a task that required concentration. They were less concerned about what the experimenter might think. Whether power is real or simply perceived, it leads us to take more risks, express stronger emotions and views, act based on our natural inclinations and impulses, and ignore situational pressure. We perceive people who interrupt others as more assertive than those who don't interrupt, and those who express anger as mightier than those who express sadness, a more socially acceptable emotion. As people gain power, they feel greater freedom to defy conventions. Paradoxically, these violations may not undermine their power, but instead augment it, thus fueling a self-perpetuating cycle of power and rule-breaking that can go too far, as with people like Bernie Madoff. The link between nonconformity, power, and status leads us to a deeper question. How should we use the power and status that we gain throughout our careers? It's early morning at Via Stella 22 on a picturesque cobbled street in the center of Modena, Italy. There is a discreet coral-colored facade, and the only indication that one has arrived at Osteria Francescana is a small brass sign bearing its name. The scene gets more lively around 9 a.m. when the staff starts showing up for work. Noise from the engine of a black Ducati motorcycle fills the street, Bottura arriving not long after his team. Within minutes, he has put on his white chef's coat and grabbed a broom to start sweeping the pavement outside the restaurant. Bottura regularly takes on tasks that other chefs couldn't be bothered with. It's Bottura who waits for the cargoes of fresh produce, fish, and meat. He is the one who jumps onto the back of the truck, opening up the big boxes to inspect the produce and ask the delivery men about it. When his questions are answered, he helps unload the truck. This is part of the excitement of working at Osteria Francescana. Everyone at the restaurant knows that there are no predefined roles that will box them in. Everyone is free to work on tasks that in other restaurants would be assigned to a particular individual. At most places, only the delivery person unloads the produce from the truck, and only the pastry chef prepares the desserts. But at Osteria Francescana, this is not the case. Everyone is free to experiment with ideas and to challenge their leader with a unique perspective. And Bottura himself shows little regard, maybe even contempt, for the idea of tradition-bound roles. Right before service, he joins his staff for a meal. In between services, he is either helping with cleanup or playing soccer with the staff outside of the restaurant. None of this is typical chef behavior. Bottura's troops are so devoted because they have seen him on the front line, and they are inspired to greatness. Chapter 2, The Dog Named Hot, A Talent for Novelty. The first kiss is magic, the second is intimate, the third is routine. Raymond Chandler. A man steps to the center of a small stage, pulls up a brown leather chair, and sits down. He is wearing a sleeveless white shirt and loose-fitting jeans. I'm sitting off stage with my husband Greg and a group of about a dozen other people. We're in a large room used by a local public school during the day, and in one section there are different areas set up for children's activities, drawing and painting, reading, Legos. The lights are dim. The man extends his hands as if gripping an imaginary steering wheel and starts to drive. I rise from my seat and step onto the stage, pull up another chair, and sit next to him. "Welcome to the Enterprise," he says. "Did you hear about the new uniform-making machine?" "Yeah," I say. "I was disappointed when I heard about it. After our last meeting, I was hoping that we would focus on another product to launch our business. Didn't we think striped underpants would be the next big thing?" Laughter. Another woman, Rachel, rises from the audience and taps my shoulder. I return to my seat and the scene continues. I wasn't sure what to say, I whispered to my husband, but somehow people found it funny. Greg smiles. You didn't get it. You totally missed the reference. That was Star Trek. Eric was doing Captain Kirk, so you took the scene in a pretty different direction. Eric wasn't driving a car. He was commanding the USS Enterprise. Greg and I were in Central Square, Cambridge, not far from where we were living at the time, at a beginner's improv comedy class I had signed us up for, 2-hour sessions across 10 consecutive Mondays. That night, we were playing an improv game called Actor Switch, in which one player starts a scene and is soon joined by another. New players step in one at a time, tapping the shoulder of someone already on stage to replace him or her, building on the original story and characters. Nothing is decided in advance, but after only a few seconds, the group has cooperatively established a basic dramatic frame. By the end of the scene, we've managed to develop a rather complex and pretty funny scene. In improv, you go with the flow. Maybe you're not crazy about the choices of the person who came before you, but you accept the terms of the scene and then add to it, rather than contradicting it. So if the first player says, "This is an apple," you shouldn't reply, "No, it is a rather small melon." That might buy you a laugh, but it would kill the scene. It's much better to follow the yes and principle that lies at the heart of improv. Yes, and we can fill it with poison before we offer it to the queen. The story I've just told wasn't the first or last time I completely missed a classmate's cultural reference. I have yet to watch Star Trek. But if I hadn't been willing to miss these cues and go with it, I wouldn't have had as much fun. Improv is all about performing without preparation and without a script, responding to others in the moment, listening to your inner voice, and bursting out with whatever comes to mind. The British-Canadian director, playwright, actor, and improv pioneer Keith Johnstone once noted that improvisation is like steering a car by looking through the rearview mirror. You don't know where you're going. You can only see where you've been. The improv experiment was a Christmas present I gave to Greg in 2011, before parenthood made it harder to go out on weeknights. I thought it would be a good gift, since we would spend some time together on a regular basis, involved in a totally new activity, one that consisted, in my mind, of just making fun of ourselves and laughing a lot. But that wasn't my only motive. Recent research suggests that if we inject novelty into our romantic relationships, we'll stay more engaged in them and experience greater satisfaction in the long run. Greg and I were happy. From the first time we met, in the security line at Logan Airport, our relationship had always felt natural and easy. Even when our different cultures, I'm Italian and he was born in Warner Robins, Georgia, introduced differences of perspective. But I knew how easy it is for marriages to suffer the grind of routine. What, I wondered, would happen if we had a weekly date with the unexpected? It had all been decided. On June 27, 2009, Greg and I would get married in Tione del Trento, my hometown of 3,000 people in the mountains of northern Italy. Picture a warm summer afternoon, the perfume from daisies and roses hanging in the air as a gentle, fresh breeze dances between the vaulted ceilings of an old church, its main doors open, waiting for the guests to enter. A little orchestra of clarinets, trombones, and flutes plays softly as the groom waits nervously for his bride. We were excited. Maybe even more excited was my mum, who would finally see a church wedding for one of her 3 children, complete with all the important traditions. My brother had decided against marriage, though he had settled down with his partner and 2 children. My sister and her husband had tied the knot at City Hall. Months before the wedding, I bought my white wedding dress. I also bought a garter, following a tradition that dates to the 14th century, when it was thought that the guest who departed with a piece of the bridal trousseau would be blessed with good luck. The groom had his own rituals to honor, including supplying the bridal bouquet as a final gift to his girlfriend before she became his wife. And then there would be the bomboniere with confetti, wedding favors with sugared almonds for the guests. For a traditional Italian wedding, the almonds must be coated in white sugar, and the number given must always be odd. Why? Because marriage unites 2 people, and the amount must never be divisible by 2. With the wedding over, we would go on a luna di miele, or honeymoon, so named because in ancient Rome, newlyweds would spend an entire phase of the moon eating a portion of honey at every mealtime. Of course, respect for tradition is about as uniquely Italian as a bride in a white dress. In Indian weddings, couples recite 7 vows and aren't considered legally married until they've taken 7 steps around the holy fire, after which 7 married women greet them. In Vietnam, families of the bride and groom avoid the number 7 at all costs because it brings bad luck. Throughout Latin America, a quinceañera, the coming-of-age celebration for a girl's 15th birthday, often involves fathers changing their daughter's shoes from flats to high heels. In Japan, during the traditional coming-of-age day Seijin no Hi, parents present their daughters with a pair of flat Zori sandals. From celebrating religious beliefs to mobilizing political action, rituals and traditions have a long history across societies. Today, they are ubiquitous forces, from our family lives to the workplace to the locker room. Notre Dame football players walk an identical route from the University Basilica to the stadium before kickoff, while employees at companies such as Walmart and New Balance begin the day with chants and stretches. Such rituals, my research shows, improve group performance. For instance, in a scavenger hunt that my colleagues and I organized through the streets of Boston, groups who practiced rituals together during the event performed better than those who didn't. Another study, this one of over 200 people working in many different types of jobs across industries, found that they were more satisfied by their jobs when they regularly engaged in meaningful workplace rituals, including playing their own version of bingo with their colleagues, and when they worked on a Saturday, regularly shouting out "halftime" about halfway through the day and doing a happy dance. One of the main purposes of rituals and traditions is to impart and nourish values. At home, daily family prayers emphasize the importance of faith. Nightly bedtime stories affirm the value of education, reading, and lifelong learning. And regular family dinners or activities strengthen our most cherished bonds. In time, shared values gain the power of treasured memories. On the flip side, given the meaning and closeness that traditions reinforce, broken traditions can give rise to disappointment. Nearly a year before our perfect Italian wedding, Greg and I learned this lesson firsthand. It was a sunny morning in early September in 2008 when we were living in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. While sipping coffee on our porch, we finally agreed that it was time to call my family. Almost 2 weeks earlier, on August 20th, Greg and I had gotten married at City Hall to address some of the legal issues related to an Italian marrying an American in the United States. I still hadn't told my mom. I knew she'd be very upset at the news, even furious. She would probably yell at me for breaking from such an important tradition. "It's not a big deal," Greg reassured me. Our real wedding, the traditional one we had so carefully planned, was still set to take place in Italy the following summer. I dialed my mom's phone number. As soon as she picked up, I said, "Mom, I have some wonderful news to share." "You are pregnant?" "No," I said, "Greg and I got married." Click. She had hung up. When I finally got her on the line again, days later, she did yell at me, as expected. She was furious that there hadn't been a single family member present to celebrate one of the most meaningful moments in her child's life. There were no wedding-themed pictures of the family, no memories she could cherish. In time, though, she got over it. I had my Italian wedding with my family all around us, and all turned out well. Rituals can bring us together and imbue life with deeper meaning, but often they also rob us of something equally valuable, the experience that comes with making difficult decisions. Planning my Italian wedding was rather easy, as most of my choices were already made for me. The hardest decision we faced was picking a date. But the process was also short on opportunities to challenge and surprise myself. In the grip of tradition, we miss out on novelty, and therefore the excitement of working without a script. Boredom, or something worse, any kind of mindless complacency, can creep up on us. The rebel, always trying new things, the way Greg and I did with improv, fares better. We stick to traditions and old ways of doing things because, at least in part, we figure there must be a good reason for them. In one study, for instance, a team of Yale researchers found that children model themselves after adults so faithfully that they even copy their mistakes. In one of the study's exercises, a group of 3 to 5-year-old children could see a dinosaur toy that had been placed in a clear plastic container. A researcher followed different steps to retrieve the toy, some of which were useful, such as unscrewing the lid, and some of which were not, such as tapping the side of the container with a feather before removing it. The children had to indicate which steps were silly and which made sense, winning praise when they identified the former. This was done to show that the adult could not be trusted and that the unnecessary steps he had used could be safely ignored. Later, the children watched adults as they took a toy turtle out of a container using needless steps. When they performed the task themselves, the children still over-imitated, squandering time and effort in the same way that the adults had. In fact, when children see an adult taking a prize from a container by a method that both adults and chimpanzees can easily identify as both inefficient and clumsy, they seem to lose the ability to figure out how to open the container correctly. In other words, watching an adult do something wrong prevents kids from figuring out how to do it right. Experience would seem to be the cure, but on the contrary, studies show that over-imitation actually increases as we age, with adults performing irrelevant actions with higher levels of fidelity than preschoolers. Hard to believe? Ask yourself the following. When trying to understand some new complicated device, like a computer, how often have you followed on faith the instructions of an expert? If you're like me, the answer is very often, as you may or may not find out later when someone else points out a simpler way to operate the device. Much of what we know is really only trust in someone else's knowledge. After all, we conclude, if a practice has been around for a long time, there must be a very good reason for it, right? In one study examining this phenomenon, I brought groups of 4 participants into a room where a team of paid actors was folding T-shirts. Some groups saw teams using an efficient process to fold T-shirts, while other groups saw teams adding a few irrelevant actions to the process, such as stacking the T-shirts in piles of 3 before folding them, or folding and unfolding the sleeves. At the beginning of the study, when participants received information about the task they would complete, they were told that they would be paid based on the number of T-shirts they folded in the allotted time. Adding unnecessary steps obviously slows down the process. The participants watched the paid actors fold T-shirts for a couple of minutes and then took their spots. They folded T-shirts individually for 10 minutes until another group came to watch them for a few minutes before taking over the work. This pattern was repeated 6 times with groups of 4 participants. Among the participants who watched teams fold inefficiently, 87% simply imitated the actions of the initial group of actors, and thus walked away with less money than those who were part of the groups that observed the efficient process. Those who watched an initial group of actors fold inefficiently for just a few minutes perpetuated this behavior across time to many other groups. Of the 336 people in the study, only 3 explicitly asked questions or raised concerns about inefficiency. As often happens in real life, most team members accepted the nonsensical process without protest. The traditions and rituals you encounter in your organization and in society often endure out of routine rather than as the result of thoughtful deliberation. Psychologists and economists alike have a name for this phenomenon, the status quo bias. William Samuelson and Richard Zeckhauser first demonstrated this bias back in 1988 in a study in which they presented participants with a series of decision-making problems that either included or did not include the choice of sticking with a status quo position. Participants tended to favor the status quo when it was offered to them, even as an objectively inferior choice. Too often, we take deeply ingrained rituals and traditions for granted. When we become comfortable with the current state of affairs, we experience any diversion from the status quo as a loss, and we weigh these losses much more heavily than the idea of potential gains. In fact, when offered a bet with an equal probability of winning or losing, the average person requires a gain that's twice the value of the potential loss before accepting. If only we could put aside the fear of losing, we might jump at the chance to win. But instead, the fear holds us back, chaining us to the status quo, even when change is clearly in our best interest. Studying the long history of improv led me home. The most direct ancestor of the art form is thought to be the Italian Commedia dell'arte. In Europe, in the 1500s, performers would travel from town to town with their troupes, performing shows in public squares. Improvised dialogue within a set scenario would serve as the framework for these performances. From the beginning, their craft broke with the traditions of mainstream theater, demanding of players an unusual ability to react in the moment. Long after the Commedia died off, improv was reinvented in the 1950s by British-Canadian playwright Keith Johnstone and American acting coach Viola Spolin. The two made separate, spontaneous contributions to improv. In their own ways, both brought novelty to the stage, believing that live theater had become pretentious and catered only to intellectuals and the upper class. Johnstone, who was writing plays and teaching acting in London, wanted to create art for everyday people, those whose favorite forms of entertainment were ball games and boxing matches. His answer? A new acting method, spontaneous improvisation, and a hybrid form of entertainment called theater sports, in which features of sports, like teams, judges, scores, and competitions, were adapted to improvisational theater. Teams would compete for points that judges would award them, and audiences would be encouraged to cheer for scenes they enjoyed and mock the judges. Kill the umpire! When working with actors, Johnstone tried to help them be more responsive and alive in their work. Informed by his own childhood, he had come to believe that the educational system was blunting creativity. Flipping the notion of children as immature adults, he viewed adults as atrophied children. Johnstone wrote down a list of things teachers stopped me from doing and told his own students they should do just the opposite. His unconventional approach and strategies were highly successful in helping actors become more spontaneous. In her native Chicago in the 1920s and 30s, Spolin had the same passion as Johnstone, theater for the masses. Her approach to teaching adults was based on the insight that children enjoyed learning to act when lessons were presented as a series of games. She had instructed immigrant children in drama as part of a public works project and realized that the same techniques could be used to stimulate creative expression in adults. Spolin's son, Paul Sills, built on this insight in the mid-1950s, helping to spearhead an improv movement centered around the University of Chicago. The group that sprang from Sills' work, The Compass, eventually led to the development of the famous improv theater company Second City, where Tina Fey, Bill Murray, and many other comedy greats got their start. In the third week of my improv adventure with Greg, the teacher asked all of us to sit in a circle on the floor. We were going to play the game One Word Story. The teacher would provide the title of the story and then pick a person to say the first word. The person to their left would say the next word, and so on, continuing around the circle. The point of the game is to tell a coherent, original story one word at a time, as if a single narrator was speaking at a normal conversational pace. "Here is your title," the teacher began. "A furry dog sits on a stove." And then we were off. A dog named Hot enjoyed sitting on a red and yellow stove. One day he did not realize the stove was on, so his butt felt warmer than usual. The story kept going, ending with a parrot yelling, "Butt on fire!" In improv, we are trading in the currency of unpredictability. We don't know what our partners will say next, how others will react, or even when a scene will end. The other players may bring up topics that we know nothing about. That's okay. The goal is to always react purely in the moment. Consider the strategies required in two popular games, chess and ping pong. When you play chess, you need to think ahead. You focus on following your own strategy as well as anticipating your opponent's. By contrast, when you play ping pong, you need to react in a split second. You can try to anticipate the next volley, but a better bet is to focus on where the ball is moving in the moment. The same goes for improv. You can't pong until the other player has pinged. Even as it makes us anxious, this unpredictability fuels our need for novelty, which runs surprisingly deep. In the 1860s, German zoologist Alfred Brehm placed a covered box of snakes in a cage with several monkeys. When the monkeys lifted the lid, they were terrified, as any monkey and most humans would be. But then the monkeys did something rather odd. They lifted the lid again to get a second look at the snakes. Since Brehm published these findings, scientists have examined the reactions of more than 100 species of reptiles and mammals to things they've never seen before. No matter how frightening the sight, the animals cannot resist the pull of novelty, and they take another peek. Novelty compels both humans and animals to engage with the unfamiliar. Indeed, our strong desire for novelty has evolutionary roots, improving our survival odds by keeping us alert to both friends and threats in our environment. As new parents quickly learn, when given a choice, babies consistently look at, listen to, and play with unfamiliar things. One of my favorite moments from early parenthood was when I watched my infant son notice his hands for the first time. His discovery stands out as a metaphor for learning. His interest in what those strange, wonderful appendages could do was his first step toward controlling them. The preference for novelty is an efficient way for immature cognitive systems to process information, helping babies cope with changes to their environment before unleashing their inner explorer. Interestingly, in human genetics, a preference for novelty has been linked to the migration of early humans to the far reaches of the Earth. Recent studies have shown that human groups that migrated the farthest from Africa had more of the genes linked to novelty-seeking. That is, the people who traveled the farthest from home may have had some biological propensity to experience mysterious new places. And yet, while we are born with a strong drive to seek novelty, this drive fades over time. As we grow older, other desires take over, like wanting more predictability. The organizations we build and join reflect this reality. Paychecks at the same time each week or month, evaluations according to established processes, jobs that involve a known set of activities. The thrill of novelty, running into an old friend in an unfamiliar city, buying a new car, accepting a promotion, can instill a sense of delight and wonder at our good fortune, but not forever after. You and your friend eventually part. The car loses its new car smell and starts to seem ordinary. The promotion brings the stress of new responsibilities. In time, we grasp a difficult truth about emotional experiences. Their intensity fades. Pal's Sudden Service is a fast food chain with 29 stores in Northeast Tennessee and Southwestern Virginia. Most are boxy, 1,100-square-foot double drive-through restaurants topped with statues of burgers and fries. Speed is a key factor at Pal's, and employees are trained accordingly. A typical order of 2 sandwiches, 2 sides, and 2 drinks takes about 43 seconds to fill. The work is highly standardized. Whether taking orders, grilling, toasting bread, or preparing hamburgers, employees learn to follow the process with zero errors, even during peak times. Responsibilities are split between 15 different stations. Employees get to work on one of them only after taking a test, and the only passing score is 100%. All businesses face the same conundrum. To stay profitable and competitive in the marketplace, they depend on the work of their people, but people always need new challenges. Pal's is the kind of place where tedium is a constant threat. But the owners have come up with a clever way to fight the tedium of highly standardized work. Not until employees arrive at work for their shifts do they learn the order in which they'll move through the stations. The first task on a Monday may be making shakes, followed by French fries. On Tuesday, it may be biscuit production and order delivery. As a result, workers are less likely to shift into autopilot and more likely to up their game. Novelty is a stimulant. Pal's has achieved impressive numbers, They average one drive-through order filled every 18 seconds. Competitors need minutes. One mistake in every 3,600 orders. The average in the industry is one every 15 orders. Scores of 98% for customer satisfaction and above 97% for health inspection. Turnover at the managerial level and on the front lines is very low. The sales numbers are similarly remarkable, about $2 million a year per store. In fact, despite operating in a highly competitive industry where global giants like McDonald's, Burger King, and Wendy's dominate the market, Pals performs remarkably well financially. On most measures, from revenue per square foot and gross margins to return on sales or on assets and customer satisfaction, Pals beats the competition. As this fast food chain demonstrates, there's room for variety on even the most rote job. My colleague Brad Stotz of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and I analyzed 2.5 years of data from transactions of employees who processed applications for home loans at a Japanese bank. The mortgage line required each employee to engage in 17 different tasks, activities like scanning applications, comparing the scanned documents to the original, inputting application data, comparing that data to underwriting standards, and conducting credit checks. After a worker completed a task, the system automatically assigned him or her a new one. We found that when workers were assigned a greater variety of tasks across a few days, their productivity, as measured by processing time, improved. Variety acted as a motivator. Novelty increases our job satisfaction, our creativity, and our overall performance. It also increases how much we grow in both confidence and ability. In research conducted by psychologists Brent Mattingly at Ashland University and Gary Lewandowski from Monmouth University, participants were asked to read a list of facts. Some participants were provided with facts that came across as interesting, novel, and exciting. Butterflies taste with their feet. While others were given information that was duller, butterflies begin life as a caterpillar. Reading interesting facts made participants believe they were more knowledgeable than reading mundane ones did. All of a sudden, they felt more like masters and more confident in their ability to accomplish new things in the future. When presented with new tasks, they worked harder on them. Part of the explanation is that in our brains, novelty and pleasure are deeply entwined. Novelty generates surprises, and surprises lead to pleasure. In a series of studies led by Tim Wilson at the University of Virginia, the happiness people experienced after an unexpected kindness, such as a gift, lasted longest when the act was anonymous. In another study, researchers had participants watch an uplifting film based on a true story. They were then given two passages describing what happened to the main character after the events depicted in the film, one true, one fictional. Both passages told positive stories, but their details differed slightly. One group was told which story was true, the other group was kept in the dark. Members of the uncertain group stayed in a more positive mood for much longer after seeing the film. The uncertainty of the situation increased their pleasure rather than detracting from it. Another factor serves as a powerful source of novelty, excitement. In a now classic study published in 1993, psychologist Arthur Aaron and his colleagues had 53 upper-middle-class, middle-aged couples fill out questionnaires asking them about the quality of their marriages. They were also given a list of 60 activities that couples could engage in together, such as dining out, going to a movie, attending concerts or plays, skiing, hiking, or dancing. For each activity, each member of the couple individually rated how exciting and how pleasant they thought the activity would be to share with their partner. In some cases, ratings varied widely. While one person may highly anticipate the new episode of a favorite show, the other may be bored by the prospect of another night in front of the TV. Similarly, one half of the couple may love to ride roller coasters, while the other person practically has a panic attack just contemplating the idea. Next, couples were randomly assigned to one of three treatments. In the first condition, they were asked to engage in an activity they both had rated as exciting, but only moderately pleasant, just once a week for 10 weeks for 90 minutes at a time. In the second condition, the couples chose a weekly activity they both had rated as highly pleasant, but not as exciting. In the third condition, couples were not asked to engage in any special activities. The researchers found that engaging in highly exciting but only moderately pleasant activities dramatically improved relationship quality. But for the couples in the other two conditions, pleasant activities or no special activities, there was no change. For an experience to be exciting, psychologists have learned, it needs to be more than novel. It also needs to be challenging. A more recent study of 100 couples found that those who engaged in activities that both members deemed exciting for at least 90 minutes per week for 4 weeks reported higher levels of happiness and relationship satisfaction. The effect lasted at least 4 months. In fact, research that has followed couples through time has found remarkable benefits in novel activities and dire consequences in their absence. Insufficient novelty makes us feel that the relationship is boring, which takes a toll. One longitudinal study found that among married couples, lack of novelty predicted especially strong declines in satisfaction 9 years later. Even very brief novel activities, such as reading through a new recipe to try, watching a movie trailer together, trying a tango move, or picking a subject at random to talk about, have been found to increase relationship quality. A study of 274 married people in the United States found that 40% of those who had been married more than 10 years reported still being very intensely in love, a state that was linked to the fact that they shared novel activities. Interestingly, when we engage in exciting activities together, we view both our partner and the relationship as exciting. What this research suggests is not that you and your spouse should learn hang gliding. Seeking novelty may involve simple activities, such as walking in a part of town you're not familiar with, checking out a new restaurant, or giving improv a try. Surprisingly, novelty is even more important than stability. In a study I conducted with a group of 300 new employees, I found that the more frequently they experienced novelty in their work in the weeks that followed, because they learned new skills, met new colleagues, or felt challenged in their tasks, the more they felt satisfied with and energized by their jobs, and the longer they were interested in staying with the organization. Stability, by contrast, did not seem to bring these benefits. When employees reported that their job felt more or less the same every day, their satisfaction suffered, and they were more eager to move on. In another study, I enlisted about 500 workers across a wide range of U.S. organizations to take part in a 6-week study inspired by Arthur Aaron's research on novelty and romantic relationships. I randomly assigned each employee to one of 3 conditions. In the novelty condition, I asked participants to carve out some time at work, at least once a week, to engage in novel or challenging tasks, such as reaching out to a colleague in a different division, learning a new skill, or working on a project outside their comfort zone. I sent them a reminder once a week for 5 weeks. For participants in the pleasant condition, I asked them to make some time at work to engage in tasks they enjoyed, to the extent possible. In the control condition, participants did not receive any instructions. At the end of week 6, I asked everyone to complete an online survey on job satisfaction, engagement, commitment to the organization, and innovative behaviors. I also sought permission to ask their supervisors about their performance. Just as in the romantic relationships Aaron studied, boosting novelty produced the highest scores on all the measures I assessed. I found the same results for employees in a large retail organization in India and for a large sample of European workers. The value of novelty at work and in relationships seems pretty universal. At PALS, managers regularly set up new challenges. One manager liked to make weekly deals with his employees, such as the following. He told a worker at the order window that if she could correctly predict the orders of 100 drive-through customers in the next hour, she would receive a $100 gift card. As the employee told me the story, she recalled thinking initially that the task seemed impossible, And I agreed. But then she told me that most of Pal's customers are repeat customers, people who drive in to get lunch or dinner 3 to 5 times a week. She noted, after a while, you recognize their faces and the order they always seem to make, almost out of habit. She claimed her prize. When Greg first opened the big box tied in red ribbon that I had put under the Christmas tree for him in 2011, I could tell he was disappointed. Being a bit of a tech geek, he was probably expecting me to get him some exciting new gadget. What he found instead was a lot of empty space and a printed-out description of our improv class, something he'd never considered doing on his own and clearly wasn't interested in. I was convinced he was wrong, that he would love it as soon as we started. But after the first session, he told me that he'd hated the class. He'd felt uncomfortable being so vulnerable in front of strangers. Worse, he didn't think he was funny. The second class didn't do much to change his mind. I can perfectly picture his face during an exercise called Three Things. The group stood in a circle chanting Three Things while bouncing our fists, as if pounding a table. The rules are simple. One person starts the game by turning to a neighbor and naming a category. Three things you'd find at the back of your closet. Three brands of cereal. Three terrible excuses for showing up late. As quickly as possible, the neighbor has to call out three responses with authority. The group chant starts up again, and the next person gets a category. Sometimes the answers fit the category appropriately, other times they don't, but that's okay. Whatever comes to mind is the right answer. The idea is to generate and celebrate a quick response. I was standing right across from Greg in a circle. A person in the group shouted, "Three things you could hide in your nose if you had to," while turning to Greg, who had no quick answer. After hesitating a few more seconds and getting encouraging smiles from others, he stopped biting his lips and said, "My finger, a raisin, a penny." At the end of the class, as we walked out of the building, three things was still on his mind. "It was so awkward," he told me. He was miserable. But soon, things began to change. Greg learned to get the most out of class without worrying what others were thinking. He embraced being in the moment and surprised himself with his own reactions. He was fascinated, as I was, by the lessons and experience each exercise unlocked. He came to truly enjoy improv. Our delight in a particular session would carry into the next day and the day after that. We started to share our enthusiasm with friends, describing the scenes or jokes we surprised ourselves with. And if Greg giggled after a cultural reference sailed right over my head, I usually joined in. Another funny thing that eventually happened to both of us, we felt we were good at something new. We never became great actors, but we learned how to put ourselves out there, to be more comfortable with both our strong and weak points, and to support each other. We had no problem making fun of ourselves afterward. And when we played Three Things again in later classes, the answers flowed with no hesitation. We'd become masters of producing answers in seconds, and the only safe prediction was that we'd end up laughing. Psychologists call this kind of experience self-expansion. When we engage in novel activities and acquire new skills, our sense of who we are expands, as does the number of traits we use to describe who we are. This, in turn, heightens our confidence that we can accomplish our goals, even when we're outside of our comfort zone. And it also increases our commitment to reaching our destination, no matter how tough the road. Aaron initially wrote about self-expansion as a side effect of being in rewarding relationships. By getting closer to our partner, we learn something new from them, and we ourselves expand, broadening our knowledge and interests. Before we took our improv class, neither Greg nor I thought we were very good at being funny on the spot. And while we don't fool ourselves into thinking we're ready for Saturday Night Live, our sense of who we are has expanded. We now know that we are capable of being silly, and thus vulnerable, in front of strangers. We grew closer to each other by sharing in this sometimes frightening experience and seeing each other in a new light. Aaron wrote about self-expansion as a natural desire to grow and change. When we challenge ourselves to move beyond what we know and can do well, we rebel against the comfortable cocoon of the status quo, improving ourselves and positioning ourselves to contribute more to our partners, co-workers, and organizations. The third week of improv class, we warmed up with a game called Hot Spot that made me intensely uncomfortable. We all stood in a circle. One person entered the center and began singing a song. In no particular order, other players took turns singing in the center. The first time I sang, I felt huge discomfort. I've never been much of a singer, and my voice sounded soft and thin. But the beauty of the experience was that I didn't really have time to focus exclusively on my own discomfort. Rather, I needed to focus outward and support my classmates, helping them look good as they suffered through their own discomfort in the center of the circle. I learned that by smiling at them, singing along, or taking their place quickly when they were struggling, I could help. As I took the spotlight in the weeks that followed, my nerves dissolved, and I found myself focusing on the excitement that came with singing new songs. My voice became stronger and more assured, even if I was still completely out of tune. Improv teaches that it is okay to be uncomfortable. Comfort is overrated. It doesn't make us as happy as we think it will. With too much comfort, we miss out on the anticipation of what's going to happen next. It's so much better to go through life like a child dreaming of Santa Claus, wondering what gifts the future holds. Chapter 3, The Vanishing Elephant, A Talent for Curiosity. Look at this life, all mystery and magic. Harry Houdini. When New York City's Hippodrome Theater opened in 1905, its builders touted it as the largest and grandest theater in the world. Spires and American flags adorned the roof, giving the Hippodrome the appearance of a grand castle. Inside, seats for crowds of more than 5,600 fanned the stage in a three-tiered semicircle. In popular magazines of the era, the theater was referred to as a mammoth showplace on 6th Avenue, supreme in size and extravagance. On January 7, 1918, the famed illusionist Harry Houdini walked across the stage, dressed all in black, with the eyes of the sold-out crowd upon him. For over two decades, the Hungarian-born escape artist and magician had been traveling the world, astonishing audiences with his death-defying escapes from handcuffs, ropes, straitjackets, and chains. He was particularly known for extricating himself from locked containers, from prison cells to milk cans to airtight coffins. One of his best-known escapes is called the Chinese Water Torture Cell. To perform the trick, Houdini began by dangling upside down with his ankles locked into a frame, before being lowered headfirst into a tank of water. If he couldn't escape within 2 minutes, an assistant standing by with an axe was prepared to break the glass, but that was never needed. Houdini broke free every time. Houdini's exploits went beyond remarkable escapes. One of his tricks involved swallowing 100 needles and 20 yards of thread with nothing more than a drink of water as a chaser. After showing the audience his empty mouth, Houdini would then reach in and pull out every single needle, fully threaded together and sometimes spanning the length of the stage. Often enough, his audiences were too dumbfounded to applaud right away. At the Hippodrome that winter, the crowd was expecting him to perform the world's most incredible illusion. Houdini stood in the middle of the stage next to a giant wooden box on wheels, about 8 feet square. "Ladies and gentlemen," he cried, "allow me to introduce Jenny, the world's only vanishing elephant." Jenny, a full-grown Asian elephant, came walking out onto the stage, standing 8 feet tall and weighing over 6,000 pounds. She raised her trunk in greeting, a baby blue ribbon tied around her neck. "She is all dressed up," Houdini said, "like a bride." 12 attendants turned the wooden box in a circle, opening all the doors to show the crowd that there was no way to escape. The doors were then closed, and the trainer marched the elephant slowly around the box before leading her inside. Houdini closed and sealed the doors, confident in his every movement. He had been a trickster from the beginning. As a child, young Harry learned to open the locked cabinets in which his mother hid the pies and sweets she had baked. Growing up, he helped supplement the family's modest income by shining shoes and selling newspapers. But when he wasn't working, Houdini was drawn to athletics and practiced acrobatic stunts. He held his first performance at age 9, calling himself the Prince of the Air. Wearing a pair of red socks his mother had made for him, he would swing on a trapeze hung from a tree. He launched his professional career when he was 17, performing magic shows in front of civic groups, at sideshows, inside music halls, and at the amusement park on New York's Coney Island, where he had as many as 20 shows a day. Fascinated by locks and handcuffs, he became an expert on them. Whenever he traveled to a new town, Houdini would offer $100 to anyone who could produce a pair of handcuffs from which he could not escape, but he never had to pay. At the Hippodrome, a loud, dramatic drum roll filled the air, followed by the firing of a stage pistol. Then the stagehands flung open the doors of the box at both ends. Poof! The giant pachyderm had vanished. "You can plainly see the animal is completely gone," Houdini announced to rapturous applause. And for over 90 years, long after Houdini's death, the trick's secret remained a puzzle that even other magicians could not solve. The 18th-century Scottish economist and moral philosopher Adam Smith is commonly regarded as the father of modern economics for having articulated the tenets of capitalism. However, Smith also made some interesting, lesser-known observations about the experience of wonder, writing that it arises when something quite new and singular is presented, and memory cannot, from all its stores, cast up any image that nearly resembles this strange appearance. According to Smith, wonder is associated with a specific body feeling. That staring, and sometimes that rolling of the eyes, that suspension of the breath, and that swelling of the heart. In ancient times, people felt a sense of wonder and awe when the sun was blacked out by a solar eclipse. And even in the modern era, when we know what causes an eclipse, when to expect it, and exactly how long it will last, the phenomenon continues to beguile. For the total eclipse that crossed North America on August 17, 2017, many thousands of people traveled to spots within the path of totality to see the moon completely cover the sun and briefly instill darkness during the day. The sight drove some to tears and left many speechless. The natural world is a common source of wonder, the birth of a child, the sight of lions and elephants on a safari, or even watching the progression of an inchworm across one's finger. Infants and children, who are experiencing everything for the first time, are likely the creatures most filled with a sense of wonder, as I'm reminded whenever I'm with my 4.5-year-old son, Alexander. Lately, one of his favorite words is, "Why?" As in, "Why is the sky blue? Why do you get receipts when you pay for things? Why can't we keep on playing? And why do we wear clothes most of the time?" Every time I am confident I've given him a thoroughly satisfying answer, he pelts me with another string of queries. Like most other young children, he doesn't assume he has everything figured out or feel embarrassed about not knowing something. He takes time to puzzle over issues and doesn't dismiss ideas that might be outlandish. This youthful sense of wonder was a central part of Houdini's personality, and it remained so throughout his life. When Houdini was 7, a traveling street circus passed through his hometown of Appleton, Wisconsin. What most captured his attention was not the clowns and acrobats, but the man in tights who climbed 20 feet into the air to a small platform and then walked across a taut wire stretched between two poles. As the crowd cheered, Houdini wondered, why was the man risking his life? How long did he have to train to be able to walk the wire? When the man suspended himself from the high wire by his teeth, Houdini asked himself, how did he do it? How many times had he performed the trick before? What if he failed? Did his teeth hurt? All these questions needed answers. Houdini rushed home that afternoon and found some rope to tie between two trees. Balancing on the rope was not easy. The first time he tried, he fell to the ground. But with perseverance, he learned to walk the tightrope. As for his attempt to replicate hanging by his teeth, it failed, as he did not realize that the man from the circus had used a mouthpiece. Out came a couple of front teeth, Houdini remembered. Curiosity has its costs. In the early 1900s, Henry Ford, founder of Ford Motor Company, was determined to find a way to lower his production costs in order to create a car for the masses. On October 1, 1908, Ford realized that vision by rolling out the first Model T. The car had a 22-horsepower, four-cylinder lightweight engine, could drive as fast as 40 miles per hour, and ran on either hemp-based fuel or gasoline. The company's engineers had developed a system of interchangeable components, which not only saved time and reduced waste, but also made it easy for workers to assemble the cars, no matter how skilled or unskilled they were. This approach was far ahead of the rest of the auto industry. Ford's single-minded focus on efficiency and minimizing costs for the Model T turned out to be a remarkable success, and by 1921, the Ford Motor Company was responsible for 56% of all the passenger cars produced in the United States. But in the late 1920s, as the U.S. economy rose to new heights, consumers began to thirst for greater variety in cars, not to mention a closed-body design, that is, a roof. Competitors like General Motors saw an opportunity. In 1924, Alfred Sloan Jr., GM's president at the time, came up with a new market strategy. He divided the U.S. car market into different segments by price range and by what he called purpose. Cars in the different segments would have different features and looks, depending on what consumers wanted and how deep their pockets were. Ford, instead, remained fixated on improving the Model T. Ford's competitors surged ahead, while the Model T started running out of gas. By the late 1920s, Ford had lost its lead position and GM had the largest share of the market. In the years that followed, Ford continued to lose market share to GM and was criticized for not understanding what customers wanted in a car. GM's Sloan was happy to observe, "The old master has failed to master change." Ford remained a follower in terms of the look and style of his cars, even when launching new models such as the Mustang, Maverick, and the Pinto. Despite some successes along the way, Ford ultimately lost in head-on competition with GM, and to this day, Ford has not regained its former position. This brings us back to Harry Houdini. If you are trying to run a company efficiently, someone like Houdini might not be your first choice for an employee. But when we look closer, we see that unlike Ford, but like Ford's competitors, Houdini allowed his sense of wonder to guide his thinking. He may have lost a few teeth in the process, but he was always elevating his craft. Even as I criticize Henry Ford, I'll admit that I personally often have the same inclination. Take a common early morning at my house. It's 6:30. The sun rose not long ago, but my 15-month-old daughter Olivia rose before it. I am half asleep and still in my pajamas making coffee. Meanwhile, Olivia is full of energy. She opens one of the cabinets in the kitchen and finds the colander. Soon she's wearing it as a hat, then as a mask. Before I know it, she's on the other side of the kitchen opening another cabinet and moving jars of spices to a new location. Next, she fixates on a tall plastic canister containing rice. She sits on the floor and shakes it. "How can I get these small white pieces out of this container?" she seems to be asking. Next, my son Alex is up and ready to join in. The kids are both giggling as they find buttons to press and drawers to open. I have to stop myself from picking Olivia up and putting an end to all this opening and closing of cabinets, all this fun exploration. Children absorb information like sponges, and they learn at a rapid pace. But as they grow, they become more aware of how others, adults in particular, see them, and they begin to rein in their curiosity. Curiosity, research suggests, typically peaks around age 4 or 5. With age, self-consciousness increases, and so does our desire to make a show of expertise. But rebels learn to hold on to this childlike curiosity, and they never stop asking why. One recent morning, Greg poured Alex some cereal and milk for breakfast. Alex was sitting on his stool at the kitchen counter, and he seemed to be thinking hard about something. Daddy, remember the food coloring we bought for Easter, when we colored eggs? Do we still have it? Greg went over to the cabinet with the baking supplies, fished out the food coloring, and put the box next to Alex's bowl. Here it is, Greg said. What are you going to do with it? Alex informed us that he was